Okay, so first of all, I beg your pardon because I haven't sent my title, and so, but I'm quite sure that you guessed that I'm going to talk about semi-analytic approaches to nonlinear shock acceleration, and some results I will show you today are part of my PhD dissertation held some months ago under supervision of Pasquale Blasi and Mario Vietri, and now I moved to Arcetri, Firenze, and I joined the High Energy Astrophysics group, and I actually work with Pasquale Blasi, Elena Amato, Gianni Morlino, and Rino Bandiera, and all these people are here or are coming here for the program, so there will be, I hope, occasion to talk to each other. I want to start this contribution by a topic which has been around for probably more than 80 years now, and then which is the origin of galactic cosmic rays. Standard picture is that as it has been proposed already in 1934 by Budd et Spicchi, is that galactic supernovae may account for the energetics of the galactic cosmic ray population. And moreover, we have that diffusive shock acceleration via Fermi mechanism at supernova forward shocks provides power laws which are, when accounted for, when corrected by the propagation in the galaxy, are the one which are needed in order to explain the diffuse spectrum of galactic cosmic rays we see at Earth. But there are some issues. Well, probably the first, it has been investigated by many of the people which are here, who are here now. So I won't go into details of how cosmic rays may have a back reaction on the shock dynamics, but I'm going to put forward some points. Well, maybe I can call some new points on all these topics. And the other problem is that even if the energetics is correct, and even if the power laws are in the right range, we have to ask which is the maximum energy that can be achieved in such an environment. And probably the last, but the less investigated, but one probably of the most important point is that how these particles which are being accelerated in supernova remnants escape these environments and are actually and become cosmic rays, and the cosmic rays we see at Earth. Clearly, all these aspects are strictly related one to each other, and there is a clear theoretical framework in which in order to understand these points, one has to develop a nonlinear theory of diffusive shock acceleration. And of course, we know that there are many different approaches, probably not many, but kinetic approaches to this problem. We have already had contribution by Hyesung and by Andrei on Monte Carlo and numerical approaches to the problem. Now I want to stress a point which is, in my opinion, it's one of the most important, that all the methods you can use to study nonlinear acceleration require an a priori description of the physics of mechanisms such as the particle transport, for instance, by defining a diffusion coefficient or even a mean free path or so on, which is the mechanism responsible for magnetic field amplification and damping, how the injection works, and how particles escape from this environment. In my opinion, some of the point of force, of the powerful point of these different approaches, are that the semi-analytic methods are extremely flexible and are computationally extremely cheap. So these basically these physics can be put and studied in a, say, in a quick way. Why Monte Carlo studies, for instance, are probably the best tools for understanding anisotropies of the distribution function, and so for studying problems like relativistic shocks. While fully numerical solution, like the one I showed, the present contribution, are very important because they allow to study time-dependent solution, and so also to for instance, investigating mechanism of transient of instabilities which may develop on the precursor, and so on. Now, I want to talk. I want to enter in some details on how our semi-analytical approach works, and basically, it's based on the solution of the stationary diffusion convection equation. And so we have the transport equation in a steady state approximation. And for instance, we can take this together with a recipe from the injection. For instance, we took the term standard thermal leakage recipe. And we can find the solution for the distribution function, which is written in which is an exact solution of the problem, but it's written in an implicit way, so that the fully spatial and momentum dependent distribution function depends on the distribution function at the shock, which in turn is which is F1, which is written in terms of this UP, which contains itself the distribution function.
Sorry, how is UP defined?
Oh, well, actually, this is the UP, the bold one is the small case one divided by the shock velocity as on the normalization, and this is actually the definition. Physically speaking, it's the mean velocity that the particle which with momentum p feels in the precursor, as one can check from this equation. Once that one has this distribution function in terms of the diffusion coefficient and shock velocity and the other parameters related to the shock hydrodynamics.
Are you treating UP as constant in X?
So UP is an integral in X.
Yeah. Because it's defined that way.
Well, yeah.
It's defined as an integral. It's basically the mean of du in dx averaged over df.
So it's integrated all over the precursor.
I mean, it's an object that is easy to useful to define, but it, I mean, you can even not write it that explicitly. The reason why it's useful that way is that you can check that it's roughly the velocity felt by particles of momentum p in diffusion.
The thing is that the u in the left-hand equation is a function of x.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's arbitrary. Can be an arbitrary
thing. U is the actual velocity. Up is just a mathematical function defined that way.
Yeah, but
u is a function of x. In fact, that's the reason why there's u in the x in here.
Right. Okay.
So this is an approximate solution to the transport equation.
Well, actually, these written in this. Sorry, say it again.
Not an exact solution to the transport equation. It's Malkov's approximate solution.
Well, this, as is written here, it's the first. Yeah, you can write the formal implicit solution, which involves a lot of integrals, and well, but it's still easily treatable with standard techniques. This is an an approximation in U over D, which is which has been checked a posteriori to be a very good approximation of the total solution.
But an approximation, yes. That's not the same as saying it's an exact solution.
No, but we can. No, sorry, but we can.
If the U in the left-hand equation had some really crazy behavior for some reason, it's hard to believe that you could get an exact solution just with.
Well, we can.
By averaging over it.
Provided the derivatives of U are well defined. The derivatives of the U of X are well defined, yes. Okay. If it develops shocks,
it's monotonic.
No.
It has to be monotonic as well as well defined.
No, if you
it doesn't need to be monotonic.
If you actually take the actual solution, which is not exactly, this is the result of the expansion.
Yeah.
The reason why we consider this is just because this way calculation takes, say, 10 seconds. If you include all those other terms, it takes 10 minutes.
You mean the higher order derivatives of U?
No, it's basically this term, exponential of minus one-third of Q and blah, 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 comes out of an expansion. But otherwise, there would be another term here, plus a double integral in X of a complicated function. It's just a matter of...
So what we're seeing here is what that term discarded.
Yes, but we checked that is important only at P much larger than P max. That's why we neglected it.
Oh, I believe that it's all.
In principle, it in the calculations as well. It's just that it takes about a few minutes instead of a few seconds.
But in principle, it's not a problem to treat the exact implicit solution. I mean, the procedure, the iterative procedure, is exactly the same, and it's still fast. So once the distribution function.
May I ask something else? At one point you had a notation that U as a function of P must increase rapidly enough. Is it gone now?
Yeah, that was. This is
another approach that was the one of Pasquale in 2002, which actually doesn't have a spatial dependence on the precursor, and so it was based on an approximation that UP, so the actual velocity felt by particle with the highest momentum, is equal to the shock velocity, which is this. That was an approximate solution, but this isn't, at least. As it's written here, it is in the first order in this integral. But in principle, we can, and we check every time we do this calculation, use the fully consistent solution of this equation. And once the distribution function is taken, I can give you the reference for.
The injection.
Yeah. Once the distribution function is given, one can work out the cosmic ray pressure, and via the, for instance, the momentum conservation equation, one can calculate the fluid velocity, the profile of the fluid velocity, and plug this result into the transport equation. And so this iterative way, it usually takes a small number of iterations, say 5, 10 at most, in order to reach a convergence of these of this solution, and so because basically one has to solve integral equation, and allows the use of an arbitrary diffusion coefficient, which has to be fixed a priori, or maybe also self-generated, for instance, model proposed by Bell, Saint-Pierre, and so on.
Again, arbitrary within reasonable, like it doesn't have to develop the, you know, single copies or other things like that. But
you say it doesn't have to increase with P now, it's not necessary that it increase strongly with P.
No,
it may be constant.
Particles confined, it could become very, very small at high momentum and you would still have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not.
But there's a cutoff here somewhere.
Yeah, there was the old method I had. I needed to establish a connection between U of X and U of P.
Sure.
And for that, you need to assume something on P.
Malkov developed his solution, of which this is the first term, as an iterative method using a D increasing strongly with P, right?
Well, he did it for bound diffusion, but he could have done it as an arbitrary one. He specialized it to bound diffusion, but this is a generalization of that, if you don't include the additional term.
Is it right that at this point R total is a parameter?
No. It isn't, because it basically the relation between R dot and R sub is contained in the momentum conservation equation.
How come that you've never used energy conservation by that?
Well, actually, we use energy conservation at the subshock for working out the jump conditions, because you know that you have to take into account the jump condition, and this will be became clear in the following slides.
It's in the scheme, but not on the screen, right?
Yeah, that's the point. Well, the energy conservation equation at upstream, if you want to say at upstream infinity, has some tricky aspects which are related to the presence of an escape flux and so on, but also this will be discussed later.
But that's the Pmax here, right? Because when you go from psi being cut off at Pmax and putting that into the momentum equation, that's neglecting some of the momentum of the cosmic rays, right?
Sorry, say it again, please.
Your psi,
yeah,
x, is basically the pressure of the cosmic ray.
Yeah, it's actually...
But it's truncated at Pmax.
Yeah.
So if there are any cosmic rays escaping above that, they take off their momentum without entering the conservation.
Yeah, this is the schema for in the case in which this equation has a boundary condition on the momentum. So there is a truncation over Pmax, and this is... equal to ask for a distribution function and its derivative, which goes to zero at upstream infinity. If you put, if you impose by hand that the distribution function goes to zero at a fixed point, the upstream infinity, in order to mimic the escape of particle from that point, you turn out to have that this integral extends up to infinity in momentum, and the spectrum of accelerated particles will develop a cutoff which is related to the extent of the shape of the diffusion coefficient.
This is the simple option. You can include the it's just that it's not more bulky.
Yeah. And this schema may be easily generalized in order to account also for oblique shocks, for instance, as been done by Bell, for instance, for perpendicular transport, second order Fermi acceleration, and it's also easy if you wanted to include a species other than protons in the acceleration process.
I think that's done.
Yeah. And now I want you to focus the attention on the maximum momentum the particles can reach during a supernova age. Following the formalism developed by Drury in 1983, we calculated, we generalized the test particle recipe for the acceleration time to arbitrary modified shocks and for arbitrary diffusion coefficient, working out this bulky equation, but what is noticeable is that this allows to study how the shock modification affects the Pmax. In particular, it's easy to show that there are two competing effects. The first one is that Pmax has to decrease because the shock modification makes the upstream fluid slowing down. And so one would expect a decrease in Pmax. On the other hand, when and this can be seen by looking at the dashed line, which is in the case of bond diffusion in the background magnetic field, which goes and the Pmax decreases as long as the Mach number of the shocks, and so the shock modification increases. On the other hand, when magnetic field amplification is taken into account, one has that the more modified is the shock, the more large is the magnetic field, and so there is a significant increase in Pmax when, for instance, one takes the diffusion coefficient cell generated in the amplified magnetic field. And there is always the trend which goes along with the shock modification. An interesting result is that using this acceleration time, one can find that the Pmax may be as high as the knee of the whole particle spectrum when the supernova is just entering the state of Taylor phase, say 500-1000 years. These results was also confirmed by Monte Carlo calculation done by Andrei and Don last year.
So Pmax comes from this time scale, from your computation of T, average of T in the ledge, yeah? Is that how you...
Yeah, well, this is the times that is a function of P, because there is an interval which goes from P injection to P, which is the time, the average time needed in order to carry a particle from the P injection to moment P.
So how do you fix that time, because you have a stationary solution?
We compare it with the age of the remnant.
So you don't take into account that the shock velocity is decreased,
and that gives a space limit.
Well, this approximation holds as long as the shock velocity has not decreased a lot, which may be the case for the Jacques dominated phase, since we do expect that the transition between the time limited Pmax and maybe size limited Pmax may happen in around this region.
I'm thinking if say the magnetic field scales with rho v to the third, it might be a strong limitation there, because your magnetic field also goes down as a function of time.
This is exactly the same limitation as it has, that it has always existed in linear theory. I mean, it's exactly the same level.
But of approximation.
In any case, this is only the expression of the acceleration time. What we use in our calculation is a free boundary kind of limit on the energy. It's not the escape time. It's the...
Oh, I see. In your stationary solutions, you put Pmax using this time scale.
We can choose of putting this time limitation or the space limitation by imposing that.
In the calculation you will show later it's a free expansion kind of thing, but this was just to show that the acceleration time remembers the modification of the shock, and that increasing the modification, the Pmax decreases slightly despite the amplification of the magnetic field, because the shock the fluid upstream is slowed down.
From the point of view of the most energetic particles, it's not slowed down very much. It's hard to know what the Pmax would be with these.
It's reduced by that little thing, you see?
Yeah, well, it's a factor 4, say, going from a slow, from small to large.
The order of thought over R sub.
Between the dotted line and the red line?
Between the peak, let's say, and...
Let's forget about the two thin dashes.
Yeah, it's a factor 2, 3, something like that.
It's proportional to the difference of the shock velocity, you know, of the shock.
Is that if you remember the formula from quasi-linear theory that Luke derived in 83, well, that thing is just a generalization in case the shock has a precursor. That's all.
So we talk about magnetic field amplification. We always know that there are some evidences by the X-ray rims of young supernova remnants that the magnetic fields, downstream magnetic fields, are amplified to a level of a few hundred microgauss. And taking the estimation for the shock velocity and the density, one can work out that in this well-studied case, the downstream magnetic pressure is at most 2-4% of the bulk pressure. So one would be, to some extent, tempted to neglect this contribution in the calculation, the dynamics of the supernova. But there is a strong caveat in doing this, because the upstream pressure, which is proportional to the downstream pressure divided by, say, factor R sub square, for instance, which is factor of 16, dominates the gas pressure if these inequalities is satisfied. And it's quite clear that for standard ambient medium, this strong magnetic field implies that the upstream fluid is dominated by the pressure of the magnetic field, the magnetic turbulence. And so we tried to develop a model in which this pressure of in the magnetic turbulence is taken into account. For instance, we start from what we call a free fluid approach, in which we take into account gas, relativistic particles, and magnetic turbulence as a gas. We work out the jump condition using the conservation equation of mass, momentum, and energy. And so here, the energy conservation enter the problem. Finding that when the shock is magnetized, there is a correction, which is driven by this parameter delta, which is in turn related to the jump between upstream and downstream of the magnetic pressure and magnetic energy density flux. And if we restrict ourselves to ordinary affine waves, we know how these two terms, Fw and Pw, can be written. And also taking into account there are the electromagnetic term and the kinetic term due to the motion of the gas due to the presence of the wave, which is driven by this delta U. And we have to take into account also that at the discontinuity of the subshock, there is a jump in the velocity and the density, which makes that incoming waves are split into a reflected and a transmitted component. And so taking into account transmitting and reflection coefficient, one can find the standard results which relates the downstream pressure with the upstream one, in the case in which the magnetic turbulence is made perpendicular, and in that case can work out the value of delta, which is seen to be proportional to the ratio between Pw and Pgas. So for the young supernova remnants we saw before, this correction has to be relevant. And so when we have an amplified magnetic field, the jump condition, so the pressure and temperature jump on the subshock, have to change. This is quite clear because to a certain extent the fluid of Alvin waves is much less compressible than non-relativistic gas. And so the presence of this component prevents the shock from a stronger modification.
Is VA defined with the turbulent field intensity, or is that just the background field?
We take in this calculation, we are adopting the quasi-linear theory for affine waves, which means that
background. Then why bother with things?
Sorry,
but you were saying before that the reason you have to do it is because the magnetic field is very much stronger than the ambient. That the self-generated turbulence is strong.
Well, of course, if the turbulence is not in the shape of Van waves, which is a correct solution in this case, in which we know what to put in this calculation, this kind of calculation is maybe very different. But the point that I want to stress is that since this effect is of order one on the shock dynamics, it's very relevant to know this is an effect which can't be neglected, because or at least you can twist the problem and say that a great uncertainty in the nature of the waves may reflect itself into as large an uncertainty in the dynamics of the shock.
But these are linear affine waves, right?
Yeah.
But as long as they stay affine waves, they are exact solutions.
Like, yeah, affine waves are exact solution.
If you restrain from saying that they develop some additional component along B0, which...
It's not the case for affine waves.
...something else, then the only velocity that makes sense there is BA. if they become something else.
If you have no resonant modes or...
So even if they are resonant, but they develop additional components of B along the field.
Sure.
But if they remain off and wedge in principle, then BA is calculated in B0. Not in the amplifier.
Strong alpha waves are the exact solution of the set of equation.
So this is also valid for strong alpha waves?
Yeah, in principle.
If they stay alpha waves, yes.
And there is a subtle point I wanted to point out, is that if one neglects this transmission and refraction coefficient also in the downstream, so neglects the fact that in downstream there are two wave trains counter going, assuming that also downstream this is the ratio, the relation between energy and pressure density is the same as in the case of one only weight train, the modification with respect to the unmagnetized case is somehow reduced, and delta prime is less than delta worked out this way. But this may be an issue because for R sub less than smaller than 3.7, the delta prime becomes less than zero. And so, while on one hand this kind of solution provides an enhancement of the pressure and temperature jump with respect to upstream and downstream, if you take into account, if you consider this relation, which is not physical because at least in the sense that it doesn't satisfy both Maxwell and conservation equation at the subshock, you got with a temperature jump which is the opposite with respect to the unmagnetized case. And this, in principle, may have also observational consequence on the temperature on the downstream. On the other hand, we can show that this additional pressure, or better, this change of the dominant component, which accounts for the pressure upstream from gas to fan waves, lead to smoothening of the precursor in the sense that the standard relation between R dot and R sub is modified by the by this term, which is proportional to W, which is the ratio between magnetic and plasma pressure upstream. And as we what observation tell us is that this W is typically larger than unity, and we can have just for a simple fluid model, we have not putting any information about acceleration, injection, and anything else. Just for a hydrodynamic point of view, the unmagnetized case, the relation between R sub and R dot is this dashed line. While if we ask for the ratio between W having this value of order, say, a few, and we consider the three stripes, which are the region consistent with the information that 2 to 4% of the downstream magnetic pressure is in the shape of magnetic turbulence, we have that the allowed relation region, which can provide the solution or the problem between R dot and R sub, are implies a smaller and smaller total compression ratio when the W is increasing. And so we can have that. We have that the magnetic turbulence feedback cannot be neglected in these young supernova remnants, and in general, very generally, produce a smoothening of the precursor.
Where did you get the thick lines? These are the allowed regions. What goes into that?
Well, you have that the downstream. You measure the downstream magnetic field, and divide it, say, for a factor of R sub square, and you get the upstream field in the hypothesis that the amplification of the fields occurs upstream. Of course, if the amplification of the field is due to some process like the Jacqueline entropy mechanism, which occurs at the shock surface, these can be very different. But still, there is a region which the only region which can basically these lines are the plots of these relation. So for a given value of W, you can find the intersection between the parameter region allowed by observation, the theoretical constraint, and have some constraint on the shock modification.
What was the value of gamma?
Oh, this is just the adiabatic index of the gas, and say 5/3 for a relativistic gas.
Well, why don't you have to include the contribution of cosmic rays into gamma?
Well,
it is a sub-shock in the field.
It's the sub-shock. It continues
to persist. So, in the conservation equation, the contribution of relativistic particles vanishes because f is continuous across.
Exactly where the point is along those stripes, then of course you have to introduce the cosmic rays, and that's what we were showing.
Yeah, you have to do the fully, say, kinetic study of the problem. But this is just an hydrodynamic constraint based on observation and the Maxwell equation.
I mean, you can assume W, but how do you measure P gas? You assume 10 to the 4 Kelvin for that.
Well, it's independent because it's basically here. You can express in order to get this relation, I use the conservation of the momentum, which naturally involves the pressure of the gas. The only parameter I fix is the Mach number of the shock, which in this case is 100, but you can do the same.
The subshock, right? So P gas includes some heating already from the precursor.
Yeah.
Well, in this sense, yeah, the heating due to the modification.
So not, if you say W is 10, it means that the precursor doesn't heat that much, but there's lots of alphane waves going on. So the cascading of alphane waves or the transfer of alphane.
Well, I'm not putting any damping in this calculation. I will show you how the damping affects these results, but it's not I know that probably I won't be able just because of time, but this is not an effect of the damping of the waves which hits the background plasma, which becomes less compressible, and that is the effect of, say, turbulent heating, alphane heating. I'm not invoking this. I'm only saying that there is this magnetic turbulence. So these smooth shocks, these smooth precursors agreement with inferred hydrodynamics from some objects, maybe not be due to any turbulent heating, but only this magnetic back reaction. Well, this is how we put in equation magnetic field amplification damping into the problem. I'll skip some steps, but what I want to show is that it's possible to find a very good analytic solution for the problem for the equational transport of an equation under a bit of reasonable approximation. But the point I want to stress is that turbulent heating usually assumes that the energy in alphane waves is instantaneously damped into gas pressure and gas energy. But if this were the case, which means that the damping rate is equal to the growth rate for the magnetic turbulence, there would be no magnetic field amplification. So the point is that magnetic, turbulent heating, it's a phenomenological way to explain the shock modification, but it's not a physical way in the sense that it's not consistent with amplified magnetic field.
Can you go? Maybe it's better. So go back for one slide.
Sorry.
Okay, so it is worth saying that if you don't include any of these things, the result is going to sit on this dash thing. So usually you see you get total compression factors which are totally out. You know, they are not compatible with observations. Now, if you do this effect, which is unavoidable, then this solution drops down here. And so you see that the total compression factors are always ranging around, usually around 10 or so. Another way that people have been invoking in order to avoid this problem is to invoke turbulence, which we don't know basically anything about. But the way, can you switch to the next slide? The way in which it has usually been turned on is by saying that the rate of damping, where is it?
Yep.
Rate of damping is given by this thing, namely corresponds to assume that this theta is equal to unity. You can clearly see from this equation that if theta is unity, Pw is zero. So you don't grow, which is obvious because you are damping all of it. So you have to choose which one you want. So if you assume damping in order to avoid the strong modification, at the same time you cannot require that the field is strongly amplified. Those two things are not compatible with each other.
Really incorporate this by saying the damping rate is just the same, a number times the growth rate?
That's what people have been.
It's one. And this number, it's one. Because this has been proposed by Mackenzie Falk in 1981, because their idea was to find a way of avoiding growth beyond the nonlinear.
But then people have been using it.
Because it turns out to be useful in order to reduce the shock modification.
That would be maximal heating, right? I mean, if you have local damping and totally damping so that your wave intensity remains small, that would be the maximum amount of heating you could. You could have something in between, you know, amplification.
Yeah, of course. But the point, yeah, of course, this is the point. But which is between means zeta equal to 0.5 to 0.9?
Well, it's a local description, so I wouldn't do it that way anyway.
Yeah. Well, but this is basically I don't know if there is a theory for predicting these.
There have been various theories proposed on damping these waves. Whether it's they don't predict that the damping rate is simply proportional to the growth rate, but you know, it's a phenomenological prescription which. If it captures the underlying physics properly, I'd be amazed, but you know, it's something to do.
Yeah, definitely.
Ask a question. Are there any observational evidence against these extremely large compression ratios at reverse shocks and supernovas?
At the reverse shocks?
Not that I know.
You would expect to have such a high compression ratio.
Not that I'm aware of. So all of this is referred to the former shock.
I think, for example, in 10.06, clearly the actual synchrotron waves have a certain length scale. So I would say that
I'm talking about compression ratios of 50 or something.
Sure, but then everything should linger in a very thin layer near the shock front, and that's clearly not what you see in 10.06, for instance.
Is that another reverse shock?
Oh, yeah, reverse shock.
Yeah.
Oh, reverse shock. I don't know.
I don't know. Okay. And once we put all this magnetic field amplification stuff into our model, our calculation problem, our kinetic calculation, we get what we would have expected, namely that the precursor smoothening, and as a consequence that the cosmic ray spectrum is somehow steeper at the highest energy, just because the subshock is the precursor is less marked. A point that I want to point out, that I want to address, is that also this may be the inclusion of this magnetic feedback has a consequence also on the maximum energy you can achieve at a given time, because smoothening the precursor, the velocity upstream is higher and the larger is the momentum. But there is another point I want to raise, which is somehow related to what John asked before, which is the velocity of the scattering center which enters the transport equation. For Rdn waves, we know the answer, and but only for Rdn waves, which is the affine velocity. But in the other case, we actually do not know how, the microphysics of the scattering between particles and waves. So, as an exercise, we can assume that the magnetic field which enters the affine velocity is the amplified one. So, in some sense, there is a mechanism which isotropizes the turbulence. And it's easy to show that in this case, as has been also shown by Bell in 78 or by Tushkin and Zarkasvili last year, the spectra of the particles are much steeper than the standard case. And, of course, the precursor are actually absent. And I will skip the details of this, but I wanted to stress that the formalism outlined above is very useful because it's very fast and there's no dynamical range limitation on the maximum momentum and the Mach number of the shock and so on. And so allows to scan this range of basically unconstrained environmental parameters, allows the inclusion of nuclei, which is a work we are doing just now, and can implement any new physics and that may become available. So we can ask how to apply this model, this formalism, to observation. Of course, one straightforward analysis, the hydro multi-wavelength one of single supernova remnants, but I leave this topic to Giovanni. And to Giovanni's talk, and what I wanted to talk now in the last, say, 10 minutes, it's how this apparatus can be used to probe the supernova remnant paradigm for the origin of cosmic rays. In order to do this, we have to understand which is the physics behind the mechanism which allows accelerated particles to become cosmic rays, and the diffuse cosmic rays. We have split the supernova evolution in two main phases. The ejected magnetic stage, in which the Pmax is increasing because the magnetic turbulence is very rapidly increasing. And as soon as the velocity of the shock begins to decrease as a consequence of the swept up material, the Pmax, the magnetic turbulence, starts decreasing. And so the supernova remnant loses its confining power and it begins to leaking particles at the highest energy. So at a given time, particles which have been accelerated before at the energy higher than the Pmax at that given time can do that freely escape from the system.
And the case, I mean, this Pmax is estimated from an acceleration time scale, not from an escape time scale, right? So a particle which is above Pmax can still undergo many, many scatterings and shock crossings. It doesn't get enough to get accelerated further. It's not released.
In this picture, I'm talking about a size limited Pmax. That was a recipe. The acceleration time was used in order to check if there was time enough for a particle to be accelerated up to Degné in a supernova remnant.
So this Pmax above which all the
this Pmax, in this, from now on, the Pmax is defined as the particles, as the momentum of the particles whose diffusion length is of order of, say, a given fraction of the supernova radius. Namely, are the particles which diffuse up the point in which there were no.
Does that drop during the set off Taylor stage? Because the other one does drop. No.
Yeah? Yeah, of course. But probably the physical.
What is the question again? If it is dropping in the set of
okay,
Taylor phase?
You know, in the free expansion phase, Pmax goes up linearly, right? Mm-hmm. And then in the set of Taylor, it drops.
Right. Yeah.
And what I understand you're saying is that when Pmax drops, all those particles which had a higher momentum immediately escape. And I don't see that because they're still scattered, right? It's just that they don't have time to be accelerated at higher energy. In fact, they're confined and undergo adiabatic losses. But I don't see that they escape.
You say downstream or upstream? Well, I can see how a particle
can't really go anywhere except upstream.
But they stay upstream, that's the problem. So they're not rescattered back, so their momentum cannot be further increased. That's what he means by escape, that they don't take part in the acceleration anymore.
And at a given time,
they are scattered back, but not enough times to double their momentum. So they don't escape, but they just don't have time to.
Yeah, the recipe is that F equals zero at the boundary, that's at the free escape boundary, good. Which is the same. The particles don't go back.
Well, we define Pmax as the, there need to be a momentum whose diffusion length is larger than, the precursor size. Such particles can be confined into the system. And these is the these particles are the one who label as escaping particles.
I think what John may be saying is that you're sort of assuming your last scattering sent them upstream of the shock, whereas there's a 50% chance that the last scattering sent them back downstream.
No, this is a ladder. It's a label. We're saying these ones are labeled as escaping. So in the context of diffusive regime, at x0, where you are imposing the free boundary, the flux is just ddf in the x. That's the flux of particles that leave the system. In reality, it won't be like that, of course.
Right, but my concern is that you're changing this boundary in time in this set of Taylor phase.
No, the position is there. It's not changing.
It's not increasing.
The fraction,
well, we don't know.
It's a fraction of our shock.
What we impose.
What is decreasing is the turbulence. What is decreasing is the turbulence.
They're caught there in more or less in the upstream, including some scattering back. They're not really gaining much energy anymore. Don't they lose energy due to adiabatic expansion?
This is if these are downstream, where actually they are feeding the expansion. Well, we label those particles upstream as escaping particles, and that means as particles injected into the galaxy and became a member of the...
I'm a little worried about that, because the particles you're labeling as escaping are probably actually caught there in this precursor shell a fair amount. That's expanding also. And that catch them in a box of gas, wherever it is, and if they're not to gain energy, then expanding the box of gas proceeds to...
Well, but from the upstream region, well, I can imagine this problem for downstream particles, which are trapped in the expanding remnant. But once a particle has reached a distance, say 10% of the supernova radius away from the shock, well, it's by definition in interstellar medium.
But so Pmax defines sort of the region of your precursor length, right? And now this precursor length is shrinking. So some particles are now outside the precursor length. That's sort of what you're saying.
Well, actually...
Or they are really outside your precursor length.
Yeah. Which now to us seems the most natural mechanism of which particles can leave.
It does depend on the precursor, that your most of your energy is at the highs and the particles. If you have a steeper spectrum, that no longer holds, I guess. Because then your precursor length, where most of the energy is around where the protons become relativistic.
Well, in this case, the shock would not be modified, and these
precursor is always the length determined by where by the size of the diffusion length of the highest energy particles. It doesn't depend on the fact that it's more or less pronounced depending on how it's set up its spectrum, but its extension is defined by the particles with the longest diffusion length.
Because the energy that these particles carry away is the energy which goes into the escaping energy, which is the term that has to be put, well, I'm going to this, just to show this, which is the spectrum of escaping particles for in a test particle, in this particle theory for a Bohm diffusion coefficient, which is well picked around the region.
The particles you label as escaping, are they able, or I'll grant you that they're far enough upstream that they're, you can think of them as no longer part of the precursor. If you label them as then streaming away freely along the, yeah, the upstream magnetic field, they're in general, particularly with all this energy in them, I don't think they really would stream freely. I mean, the old classical driving out plane turbulence in the interstellar medium will occur.
Well, but
if you let them then have to get through that, do they escape fast enough that the shock doesn't just catch up with them?
Well, but at this point, the diffusion properties will be exactly the same as other particles in the interstellar medium.
Well, what John is asking is if the streaming instability is not enough already at that point, because they contain most of the energy since the spectrum is flat. But the growth rate of the Alvin wave scales like the number of the particles, not like the energy of the particles. So yes, they contain a lot of energy, but the streaming, the growth rate for streaming instability is small because you're already.
You want the growth rate of this stuff, the criterion you're sort of looking for is sort of true, or maybe show is true, is that the growth rate of stuff that escapes is low enough that they can essentially free stream to the interstellar medium faster than the shock is expanding.
Right. So basically, what we have is the diffusion coefficient as a function of S, and at some point it saturates over on the interstellar medium diffusion coefficient. So at that point we say they're gone.
Actually, the position of this free escaping boundary has to be determined by this kind of phenomena.
So the classical answer that the interstellar medium folks used to give is that they can only stream at the Alfvén speed in the interstellar medium, which is slower than the shock is expanding. So these particles have to not obey that old-fashioned rule, because then the shock will certainly catch up with them all over again, and they're not free to escape.
But the gyro radius is very long then, suddenly, because the magnetic field.
Well, there's another criterion here that's different than the one he's quoting, which is that the gyro radius becomes bigger than the shock. Then I think everybody would agree that stuff.
The gyro radius in the interstellar
medium.
In the field of the supernova. That's the point, right? So once the particle has reached a place where the diffusion coefficient is no longer self-generated, if you want, then at that point, basically its larger radius is like 100 parsec. Well, probably it's not 100, I don't remember the number.
Yeah.
It's 10 parsec, it's anyway big enough that it can leave the system. That's the logic.
I was wondering whether it's true.
That's true. But yeah. Unfortunately, there is no, as far as I know, there is no better way of doing this within this context, at least.
And, how much time do we have? 5 minutes. Okay, but there is a very important point in this picture, is that the escape spectrum, the spectrum of particles escaping from this, is with a good approximation at point at delta in P max at any given time. So the fact that the spectra inside the remnant is e to minus 2 or whatever, as given by Fermi prediction, has no consequence. The spectra of escaping particles is no way related to the spectra of particles which are confined in the subshock. These spectra can be probed by multi-wavelength analysis and so on. So the e to minus 2 spectra remains a good guideline for observing emission from supernova remnants. Now, if you wanted to understand which is the spectra of particles escaping from a remnant, this in principle could be very different from the standard prediction of Fermi of e to minus 2 for a strong shock.
They all escape, right, when the shock stops.
Well, but at this point they would have. Well, but is this process sudden or they are instantaneously released? And which is the convolution of all the spectra accelerated at different ages of the remnant?
Main problem waiting till the whole remnant evaporates is that you're gonna start fighting with adiabatic losses.
Yeah. And that's we are including too in the next two slides.
Of many years ago.
Okay.
That's what they were doing.
And but the reason. Okay, we skip the details. And but the reason, I'm sorry that many relevant formulas are in the lower part of the screen, but we can do a back of the envelope estimate of the spectrum of these escaping particles by assuming, for instance, that at each time only particles with a given energy Pmax escape, and so by equating the energy density in these F escape is the fraction of the bulk energy which goes into escaping particles and the distribution and the energy at energy Pmax, we can get that the spectrum of escaping particles is proportional to this scaling, and if F escape is roughly constant in time, and if the evolution of the radius of the forward shock with time is the standard self-similar set of prediction of nu equal to 2/5, then the spectra of escaping particles is still p to minus 4, which is, in a certain sense, which this is a back end of the envelope calculation. We are doing it by using our method and so on. But this may be useful as a guideline in order to say that the naive prediction of this mechanism we outlined, it's not completely wrong, probably. I mean, it cannot be ruled out by by naive objection. So we are implementing all what I showed you before in a shock evolution according to a self-similar solution a la Truller and McKee, and we're putting some recipes for magnetic field amplification and the batic losses, and by assuming the particle escape from upstream at a given fraction of the supernova radius, and then also downstream if the particles feel has a diffusion length which is larger than the distance between forward shock and contact discontinuity, this has to this cannot be confined anymore. And very quickly, I can show you this is the flux of particles which a supernova is expected to inject into the interstellar medium for this parameter and assuming bomb diffusion. The blue line is the contribution from any given, it's the convolution of all supernova lifetime of particles escaping from the free escape boundary, while this other line which makes the total spectra of escaping particles is the one of particles which are leaking by the downstream, which are.
How long did you evaluate the run for this?
Well, these are 200 points. I mean, I ran my code for 200 time step, and it took.
It's 10,000 years, 20,000 years, how long?
So this is the age corresponding to the one in which Pmax is, say, 10 GeV, which corresponds with our recipe for magnetic field amplification damping to, say, 40,000 years, which is actually the end of the set of Taylor, or the set of Taylor stage. Clearly, the details of how the damping works may affect these the age in which remnant is not expected to accelerate particles anymore. And we can play with our ignorance of some ingredients, and so changing the properties of diffusion by putting a self-generated diffusion. And what we can see is that the cutoff is shifted toward higher energy. And if we take and that spectra are the spectra I showed you before are consistent with P2-4, but if one plays with by putting the Fermi velocity in preferred magnetic field, and so taking into account the velocity of the scattering center with the same parameter as before, the spectra is much steeper than in the case without this effect. And also, if taking one tunes the environmental parameters into extreme cases, which is maybe type 1 like supernova remnant with a cold or with a warm interstellar medium, or type 2 supernova remnant, in which in this plot there are no winds or pre-stellar, pre-supernova evolution, which with a hot with an interstellar medium, with a circumstellar medium is in a hot phase. The results can be very different. And for instance, this case, which may be interesting because about 1/4, 1/5 of the the 80% of a galactic supernova remnant I believe to be a type 2. So this case may apply for most of the cosmic ray accelerator in our galaxy. And so this could be a hint that this effect, the effect of Alvena wave, and then of the then velocity in the amplified magnetic field, may be an answer of how producing a spectra at sources, which are at the injection, which are steeper than P2-4, which are required in order to fit what we observe at Earth once corrected by the standard diffusion model in the galaxy, which is a steepening of a factor of 0.5, 0.6, 7. And so I'm finished, and I will leave you with what we think are the open issues about the understanding of galactic, the understanding of galactic cosmic ray spectrum, and so which is the contribution of different supernova times and the roles of winds and so on, which is the contribution of heavy nuclei. We are working at this at the present, and then all the other problems which are outlined here may enter, which are basically poorly known, may enter the determination of the galactic, the supernova remnant contribution to galactic cosmic ray spectrum.
Okay, thank you.
I suggest we have further questions at the coffee.